Hello, everybody. This is Craig D. Lindsay, a.k.a. Uncle Krizzle, a.k.a. Black Larry David, a.k.a. Anastasia Bieberhausen, a.k.a. Unemployed Mayweather, all those, a.k.a. all that fun stuff. Welcome to another engulfing edition of Motherfuckers I Know, the podcast where I talk to motherfuckers I know because I'm bored, mainly. And, you know, as today's guest on the Krizzlecast is, not too long ago, I talked to a man who ran a website called CriticSpeak.com, Danny Baldwin. We talked about many things, you know, film criticism and whatnot. And there is another person who runs that website as well, and he is the guest today. So, James Frazier, welcome to the Krizzlecast, sir.
Well, hey, thanks for having me on. It's cool to be honored along with a number of your other guests whom I respect very much. So, mm-hmm.
Well, yeah. First off, I'm calling you from Iowa.
It's Cedar Falls.
Cedar Falls.
Cedar Falls, Iowa. Yep, home of the University of Northern Iowa is its claim to fame.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm just seeing, I don't think I've ever spoken to anybody from Iowa before.
And, well, I'm a transplant of sorts. I'm actually originally from Mississippi, but I lived in Iowa for 14 years, so which has been my whole adult life, so I kind of consider myself somewhat of an Iowan and somewhat of a Mississippian, but, yeah, I guess I could qualify then.
Mm-hmm. And I just was, you know, trying to get the whole lay of the land with Iowa. Just, you know, how is it for somebody like you who reviews films and co-runs the Critic Speak site? You know, I'm just basically getting with, like, how do you get to see are there movie theaters in Iowa? Is there different things? Because, you know, just when people say Iowa, just think, oh man, is it just cold all the time? Is it just wet farmland and everything? Just like how do you do your thing? How do you roll?
It's not really a good place for a cinephile at all because, you know, there really aren't a whole ton of movie theaters. Des Moines has some good stuff. They have a good indie movie theater and, you think of it just, you know, your regular multiplexes. I mean, you know, nothing with 30 plus screens typically, but, you know, 12 or 15 or whatever. And, you know, we don't really get a whole lot of the smaller releases, certainly not in my town. Once in a while we get lucky, and, you know, when Oscar season's around, some of them start to trickle in. Like, we just got Spring Breakers recently, and I was kind of surprised we did. But, you know, really, in a sense, it has helped me being here, because I really have very little competition in this entire state of people who are actually trying to write about movies and talk about movies. You know, if I lived in, you know, New York or L.A. or almost any kind of big area, I mean, who knows, I might not have even bothered. But here, there's not a whole lot of people trying. So, in a sense, I've been able to, you know, make a decent amount of money writing about movies just because I've been in an area where there, you know, a very small number of people even attempting such a thing, much less doing a half-decent job at it. So, I guess in that sense, it's okay. But, yeah, I definitely, I miss... Well, I wish I was in an area that was a little more product for me to sample. I visited Los Angeles a couple of years ago, and, you know, almost all I did was just see movies that weren't in Iowa. And people said, like, well, you know, why the fuck did you go to Los Angeles just to see movies? But, you know, if you ask that question, you probably aren't, you know, much of a cinephile. So
people were giving you a hard time because you went to another town with with a lot more theaters and everything to see movies?
Oh, you know, I don't know if I really got too much of a hard time. But, yeah, you know, most of my friends friends here and people I know here probably wouldn't make seeing movies a priority almost no matter where they went, but, you know, of course for me, I went in early 2010, so I was seeing stuff like, Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans, and, The Messenger, and I saw six or seven while I was there, and then watched a bunch more, like, screeners that, a friend of mine had, but, there aren't many people around here who really take movies as seriously as me, which I don't feel sort of weird saying that because you have people on your podcast all the time that probably take them far more seriously than me, but here I'm somewhat of an obsessive about it, but yeah. The average person, so.
I'm just curious seeing what places you go to in Los Angeles. Because when I was there, I went to the ArcLight, and I forget who I was talking to about this. ArcLight is in Hollywood near Amoeba Music, right across the street actually, and they got the Cinerama Dome, and that was an interesting experience. And then afterwards, I went over to the New Beverly to see the Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai.
So, oh, man, that's cool.
So the whole thing was, and then Peter Weller was there to introduce Peter Weller and Billy Vera from, I think, Billy Vera and the Beaters. And they were there to introduce that. So that was, like, an interesting experience. I mean, where were the places that you went to?
I'm a little hard-pressed to think of titles. I remember. I did actually, funny enough, Danny, my co-owner, he probably remembers the places I went better than I do, even though he didn't go with me.
Yeah.
I went to the ArcLight, and we meant to go, but for some reason it just, like, didn't end up in the schedule. You know, when I was there, I didn't really have a huge budget, and I was staying with a friend of mine, and he had to work during the day, and so I really had to rely on someone else for rides. You know, I really didn't want to pay hundreds of dollars for a cab, and I didn't even attempt to the bus system, so I really it was my friend Mercy, really, so we kind of went to, like, the theaters he wanted to go to, we did go to Grauman's Chinese Theater, so I do remember that. We saw The Book of Eli, and that was a really good movie-going experience, actually. I was surprised how cool it was in there. Did you go there, by any chance?
No, I did not. I didn't hit that whole, you know, Hollywood and Highland area for various reasons. One, it was too damn crowded to even. I was driving around there on a Saturday night, and you just could not go near that place because, you know, the traffic was so crowded. But I was wondering, actually, did you get since you're around there, did you get flanked by homeless people in superhero costumes looking for pictures, money?
Yeah, there's no shortage of those and beggars and all that kind of thing, which I'm not particularly fond of. But, you know, it was a decent time and all. It was cool to go see, the handprints. I mean, it seems like such a touristy thing, but it was interesting that so many of those were still just, you know, the old movie stars. So you'd have, like, you know, Dick Powell's handprints, and you think, like, you know, probably only a quarter of a quarter percent of people who even show up here now know who that is, but it's a kick for me, but other than that, I'm well also for specific names. I went to, I can't remember, did you see the Slam and Salmon, like the Broken Lizard movie?
No. I haven't seen Broken Lizard. I think the last Broken Lizard movie I saw, I don't even think this one counts, was the Dukes of Hazzard.
I don't know if I would count that one. I mentioned it because there was a movie theater in a mall in Beverly Hills, and it was pretty old, and the screens were, like, the biggest screen there was still fairly small, and I had time to kill, and I saw the Slammin' Salmon, and it was the only theater in the country that it was playing at, and the theater was, no joke, as big as, like, my father's TV, you know, it's like 100 inches. It's like screen in an actual movie theater.
Yeah.
I guess I should have expected that existed somewhere, although I'm surprised it'd be in a mall and they charge, you know, $8 for, you know, or like the, you know, crappiest movie theater you've ever been in. But, so I guess I got a pretty good amount of some of the diversity of the LA theater experience, you know, to be a theater, like we went to a chain theater, I can't remember which one, but, you know, they had like reserved seating, and I thought that kind of, that was really interesting. And to me, I was surprised how well-behaved all the audiences there were. I mean, I always hear horror stories about, you know, movie theater audiences just destroying the film, but I didn't have a bad experience there, so I was pleasantly surprised. But then again, I kept seeing all these indie movies, so if I'd have gone and seen, you know, something a little more appealing to a certain demographic, that might have changed.
Well, if you went to a theater with reserved seating, you probably went to the ArcLight, and I'm still blown away by the fact this was an indoor mall in Beverly Hills, right?
The one I went to with the reserved seating, I saw Youth in Revolt, which I actually just rewatched yesterday.
Yeah.
I love that movie. It's underrated since Used Cars, but anyway.
Yeah. But I was talking about like the mall where you saw Slam and Sam, and that was an indoor mall, right?
Yeah, in Beverly Hills.
I'm kind of blown away that you had to go inside a mall to see a movie. Like, they don't even have, I didn't think those existed anymore. Like, the mall with the theater inside. The built-in.
Well, we never wanted to see your mall. I mean, the theater, it's kind of almost, it's like attached to the mall, so you really enter the theater through the exterior. You enter it through, like, the shopping part. But, yeah, you haven't been to one in a while?
No, I'm just saying that usually the mall, there are often theaters right next to malls, but just like, but they're off their own entity. They're their own island.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because, of course, like a lot of the multiplexes now, they're 20, 30 screens, so they're their own thing. There's not any movie theaters actually built inside malls anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's maybe the places I've been to. Like, you know, I remember growing up, there were a lot of malls that had movie theaters inside them, but as time has progressed and then movie theaters have became their own thing, they're just like their own separate thing. So just like, it just fascinated me, this little detour into what we're talking. So
well, the reason I was at that mall was because my friend that I was staying with, we were hanging out the night before, and we got like a, this is kind of a weird story, but he got like a jar of candied almonds and ate the entire thing, which is full when he started, and then he ate the entire thing in like 15 minutes. I don't know what he was thinking or not thinking, and he got violently ill about 10 minutes after that, and the next day he called in sick to work and couldn't do anything, so he basically just like dropped me off at the mall and have at it for 8 hours or so.
Just go over there while I, you know, lay on the bathroom floor trying not to, you know, vomit through each end and stuff like that?
Yeah, that was pretty much exactly what happened. So that was about a solid day of my Los Angeles experience was this mall in Beverly Hills. So, I mean, if that movie theater hadn't been there, then, yeah, I don't know, I probably would have just had to put a cab ride on the credit card and just deal with it, so.
It's crazy how we went off into this whole thing about your Los Angeles trip, and just considering haven't really gotten much into who you are, apart from the fact that you live in Iowa, and you was, and you born and raised, I believe, in Mississippi. And you do reviews for CriticSpeak.com along with Danny Baldwin. I mean, you guys basically run that show. I know you got other contributors and everything, but it's basically you two, right?
We do account for the vast majority of the writing on the site, yes, and we do, you know, all of the editing. So it's pretty much just us. But you know, we're always on the lookout for, you know, anybody who would want to contribute and contribute, you know, well. But for now, almost a year. I can't remember the exact day it started, but I'm pretty sure it was, you know, April last year. So, and it's been really cool for me. I can't speak for Danny, but it's actually been one of the better experiences of my whole movie reviewing career working with him. He's a really fantastic editor, and, you know, I can't, like, stress that enough, how good he is at it. And, you know, I've worked with a ton of editors, newspapers or websites and all that stuff, but he's maybe one of the only ones that I can, when we're working on a review, we can just talk on Facebook and whatever, and you know, kind of discuss every little aspect of whatever piece it needs to be discussing. So I think I've grown a lot from it. So I hope to some extent he has too. But yeah, whatever.
Well, how'd this bond begin, where you guys got together and say, hey, let's start this up? Because I know, of course, Danny did BucketReviews.com before he embarked on this. So how did it all come about?
Well, I remember I actually came into contact with them through the Muriel Award. So we have that, you know, with Steve Carlson and Paul Clark to thanks for the introduction. And, you know, I kind of got in touch with him through that years ago, like well before Critics Speak. And, you know, I think then, since Facebook has a chat mechanism, I think I added him on there and we started talking. And, you know, we just kept in touch through there and Twitter through the years. And at some point we were just chatting and I think he suggested it, but I'm pretty sure he did. But whatever, we were talking and, you know, one of us at least said, like, why don't we do a website, and that idea sort of gestated for 6 months to a year, and then one day we were talking, and we just said, hey, well, let's do it, and, yeah, we got it started, and it's been pretty cool since. I mean, we've had a little bit of an evolution with it. We started it trying to repost news stories and trailers and things like that. I shouldn't say repost, but, you know, we would find, you know, Variety would post something, and then we would, you know, source them, but we write our own article about it, and eventually we decided that wasn't really maybe the direction that was working out for us, so now we're a lot more movie review-centric, and we've been doing that for a while, and yeah, you know, me and him, I know he's done about 100-something reviews for us. I actually don't know what my own count is, but, yeah, we try to do good work. I think sometimes we definitely have, so.
And trying to see about going about, of course, figuring out how this all began for you. You know, I mean, was it kind of something that started back way back when in the mighty Mississippi? When was there? A taste of cinema down there, Mississippi, and you started to see a lot of films and everything?
Well, my first go in movie reviewing, I actually lived in Selma, Alabama at the time.
Ah, man.
In 1997. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was pretty much kind of a movie geek even at that age, about as much as, you know, somebody who's, you know, I don't know, 12 years old and didn't really have a lot of access to, cinema. You know, there's the Blockbuster in the town, Selma, of the famous march and all that. They had a twin theater on the outskirts of town that almost no one there went to. But I always loved movies, and I loved, my mother loves movies, so I think I got it to some extent from her. And I remember I'd always read, like we get, I don't remember what they were called, but, you know, you get, like, catalogs advertising movies, and you could read the descriptions and the years, and I'd memorize the years, so I knew about all these movies that I'd never seen, just because I would obsessively read these, and the numbers would stick, and I sat down, I started reviewing, and I did all these capsule reviews from, you know, a 12-year-old's perspective, and I don't think any of them were good by any stretch of the imagination, but I guess it was a nice little project for someone my age. And I took them to school, and the kids all said I had no idea what I was talking about, and my taste was terrible, and blah blah blah.
What were they feeling at the time?
Oh, I remember I had a lengthy argument with a good friend of mine over whether or not Black Sheep was a good movie, and his position was that, you know, it was, you know, one of the funniest movies ever made, and I said, not really. Because things like that, or whether, you know, just how plausible the plot of Independence Day was, things like that, or, you know, whether or not Star Wars should be classified as a war movie, and they assured me that since the word war is in the title, that solved that issue. So, I can't really say I got a lot of meaningful conversations out of it, although perhaps it did prep me for interfacing with the public later on to the minor extent that I have. But, I did that for, I don't know, a while. I don't know how many I wrote, probably a few dozen or 100 or something like that. And then I dropped it. And then years later, I found actually Roger Ebert's website, and I found that you can basically look up any review he'd written. And at the time, it went back to, I think, the 80s, and then go all the way back to 1967 like it does now. And I read those obsessively. I must have read a couple thousand reviews of his or something like that. And that's really actually where I started to kind of get a taste for film criticism. And I read, you know, other critics and everything. Like a lot of people, though, he was really, you know, the base of my movie criticism introduction. And I actually started up a blog in 2005 when I was 21, and that was when I first wrote a few, and then I started reviewing for the university paper I was at, Northern Iowa, and they actually let me review two movies a week, and then I started reviewing for the local paper, the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier, so at one point I was reviewing three or four movies a week, and, you know, I graduated, I got my master's in 2009, so I can't write for that paper anymore, so then I was just writing for the local, and then and I started Critics Speak, and that's the brief history of my movie reviewing career, so.
Oh, you have a master's, you say?
Yes, in English, or creative writing is the emphasis.
Has that worked out well for you?
Oh, man,
I don't mean to get this
I don't know.
You don't know?
It's hard for me to say, really. I mean, at some point I've toppled myself because I've stayed in this area, and there's really only so much you can do. And normally, if it had been years ago, I'd have no problem teaching basic English classes at UNI or maybe one of the community colleges. But it's, you know, there's a lot of budget cuts, things like that. And, you know, there's a... Not a whole lot to do with it around here, and honestly, I'm not sure there's a lot to do with it anywhere. Out of everybody I graduated with, not everybody has gone on to be in their field usually. Or, I mean, I think I'm actually one of the luckier ones, which is strange to say. You know, I've gotten to do a bunch of work for the Washington Times, where previous Grizzlecast guest Victor Morton works, and that's been really cool. But I didn't think I did that before I even got my master's, or maybe shortly after, but it didn't have anything to do with the master's, so it didn't really help me with that. So, no, I'm not really sure it has. I guess creatively, I probably got a lot out of it, working on fiction and doing my thesis, and, you know, I get to meet a lot of wonderful people, so in that sense I did. So I can't say I regret it, but I'm not sure I would do it again either, to be totally honest. It's a tough call.
Well, I didn't say ask you if you regret it or anything. I was just trying to see, you know, because, you know, that's a thing that people have been suggesting to me. It's like, maybe you should go back to school or graduate school and do something. And my first thought is always, why in the hell do I want to do that? Like, why do I want to go back to school and deal with more student loans and have even more dreams? I'm still hooked. I still have the high school dreams or high school / college dreams. They're all bunched together where I'm there, and I'm either late for a class or late for a test, or I haven't been going to a certain class or something, and that's my grade is still And it's funny how just the school mentality still sticks with you even in when in your mid-30s.
Yeah.
It's just, and I'm assuming the school dreams is just, you know, metaphors on how I'm not really I don't really know that much. There's still a lot I have to learn, a lot I have to accomplish in order to graduate. I'm just, you know, I'm spitballing here. It's hard for me to go, you know, Freudian on this whole thing. But it's just do you have dreams like that?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, that's why, you know, honestly, if I didn't have any dreams like that, I guess I probably would have gotten a degree in, I don't know, law or management or marketing or something. It would probably be assured to be more lucrative. I mean, that's really what I'm doing to some extent. I'm chasing the dream. You know, my dream was always to, for a while, it was actually to be like a professional movie critic. I guess to some extent, I have succeeded, and I'm proud of that. But you know, I'm not making enough money right now that I could be satisfied in 10 years. It's just not gonna work. So, I'd really like to. I'd like to get my novel published. But that's that's a whole. Almost a whole other subject. So, but yeah, that's I still have those. I mean, if I didn't, I don't know. I'd probably obsessively work towards buying an apartment complex or something. But
yeah.
They're still there. I'm writing about movies and stuff like that.
What is your novel about?
It's about the simplest way to put it would be it's basically a thriller, and it's about like a. Kind of a disgraced ex detective, and he gets involved with a gangster's wife, and you know his fortunes dramatically decline from there. Is the simple way to describe it. So,
well, if you do not publish that novel, you could turn into a pitch for an NBC drama that has.
I thought of screenplayifying it, but I'm not there yet. In some ways, it probably would take a pretty decent script because I'm, you know, I read a lot, but I watch so many movies. I feel like when I think of stories, they tend to actually kind of be closer to what you would traditionally think of as a movie instead of a book. But I try. That's the hard part. It's after being so used to, you know, your pretty high structure of most films and all that, you know, you realize the book is not exactly like that, or not, most of them don't tend to be, so, but, I've tried, but I haven't tried to get it, but I haven't actually made an effort at getting it published yet, so, I've yet to actually fail at that task, so I guess we'll get there when we get there.
Yeah, you ever tried doing the whole, Kindle route? Well, you know, just...
I actually have put a decent amount of thought of that in the lately. I haven't made up my mind. I would, like most writers, you know, the ideal is that you would, you know, get some actual book company that's going to, you know, put ink to paper and put it in a physical bookstore. But, we're working for a decent number of people. I saw some people on Twitter who... You know, basically publish a novel or two a year on the Kindle, and I don't know if they make a great living or not off of it, but I mean, someone does, so I've considered it, but I'm not there yet. So I need to have at least one or two people who are really good at editing look it over first, that's for sure.
Okay, and yeah, it has me, thinking about a couple of things. Because, you know, just, at least you got a novel under your belt, and it may not be published, but it is a novel, and just, it's something that being a writer is, even though you are, you know, you want to be a professional movie critic, but just a writer in general, I mean, something you, always, strive to achieve, and just what was the influences you had, apart from Mr. Ebert, of course, that led you up to writing in novels such as this?
Well, literary influence, my main one, or my primary one, that definitely the tone of what I've written seems to most closely resemble is James Lee Burke. Are you familiar with him?
Well, I'm trying to remember, like, I know the name, but I don't think I've read his stuff.
Yeah, he had two movies are adapted from his book. There was Heaven's Prisoners in 96 with Alec Baldwin, and then In the Electric Mist with Tommy Lee Jones, and that was 2009 or something, if you saw either of those.
Heaven's Prisoners, because I remember that film, and this actually kind of reminded me of kind of an idea of just what, from your description of your book, that's kind of what seems to be kind of in that same vein as Heaven's Prisoners, and so I'm assuming.
The movies are nowhere near as good as their source material, and really, I'm surprised they would even try to adapt it, because he writes these mystery novels, but they have such a literary flavor to them that, I think a lot is lost in translation there. But his stuff is, he's pretty much my favorite author, but there's other writers who have left some decent influence. One would be actually another film critic, but not as film criticism, is Stephen Hunter. And
Bobby Lee Swagger.
Bobby Lee Swagger. I just won actually a copy of the latest Swagger book signed by Hunter off of the Facebook giveaway. I was really thrilled by that. But his novels, I don't write in like the style like he does. I do like these books about these, really hard men who, getting a lot of shootouts and stuff like that. So I think there's maybe a dash of him in there somewhere, because I do write a lot of violence. not as well as he does, but I don't think anyone does it as well as he does, so I shouldn't feel too bad. But he's one too. Funny enough, I never really, he basically retired from film criticism about the time I found out who he was, but he didn't really seem to like much of anything, so he influenced on me in that department. So
I believe he liked Hudson Hawk.
Did he?
Yeah.
I do know he liked My Super Ex-Girlfriend, which is a real piece of shit, if there ever was one, and he favored that, and I do remember he wrote something where he didn't say he disliked 2001, but he said it was massively overrated, and I remember on Ebert's website, Ebert said, sometimes you're just wrong.
It kind of, I guess, about time we kind of address this thing. I don't know if we should call it an elephant in the room, but you made mentions to working at the Washington Times, where, of course, Victor Morton works as well, and you just mentioned Stephen Hunter, both Morton and Hunter are well-known conservative critics, and the Washington Times kind of seen as a conservative publication. You yourself, have also done time contributing pieces for Big Hollywood, which is a big conservative Hollywood journalism website. And so just... And the funny thing is, just like, I always... I've always had an idea or feeling that you were conservative. My mind is hazy all the time, and just I vaguely remember. I don't know if there was this discussion we had on Twitter revolving guns or something, and just something that's just I believe you kind of just came out to me as being conservative or something like that. So I don't know, just trying to see about that side of your life. Like would you call yourself a conservative, or just what kind of, or something?
Oh, yeah, Yeah, I mean, I'd qualify. I don't know. I mean, maybe I'd be, some might say I'm more libertarian and conservative, and honestly, I sort of seesaw back and forth on those two labels and even my views themselves, you know, might shift from day to day. But, I mean, yeah, it's accurate. I mean, I'm definitely one of the rare film writers who has such a point of view. Actually, one of our contributors to Critics Speak found us because he once Googled something like right-wing movie critics or conservative movie critics, and my pal Kristen Toto, who works at Big Hollywood, had written an article about, you know, conservative movie critics, and he was kind enough to list me in there along with, you know, like Kyle Smith of the New York Post and people like that. So, I mean, I just qualify, although I really, you know, I don't do a whole lot of political writing, even in reviews of political movies and stuff. I tend to steer clear of it. I mean, maybe not so much that I don't want to talk about it, but a lot of the time, you know, I want to make sure I make as good an argument as possible, and there's certain issues that I just don't religiously study, and if I don't religiously study it, I tend to try not to say anything about it, but, you know, it's, also I have the vast majority of my fans, if you are, not conservative at all, so I also am somewhat mindful of my audience. I mean, even in Big Hollywood, I mostly just wrote straight movie reviews without very much partisan anything, so.
Well, I guess, we could go into how you got to this point where you had this stance. How did it build up in your life where you're just like this libertarian or whatever you see yourself as?
Yeah, well, it's pretty uninteresting, actually. I suppose it's just because both of my parents are very conservative people, and, you know, statistically you're going to limit your parents' politics, and you know, so I always was basically told from, you know, childhood to adulthood that, you know, this is the, you know, ideal way, this is the ideal ideology, maybe. It wasn't anything, so yeah, I didn't have any grand realization about it over the years. It's kind of, you know, I've learned a lot more, and hopefully I have some sophisticated opinions, and I definitely consider myself highly tolerant of others. But there was never an aha moment or anything. It was just, you know, pretty much part of who I was from the start. And where I grew up, that was pretty common. It was hardly, it's not like in Iowa where, you know, probably 70% of people my age are liberals or Democrats or whatever you want to say. I mean, you know, if I was in Mississippi or Alabama or whatever, almost everybody was like a Republican or a conservative. So it just stuck with me through life.
Well, you find being in a place like ours, and even being in a position you're in, where you're a movie critic, do people know or hear that you are, you have these values and ideologies, and are they standoffish, or are they ready to attack you?
I guess anybody I'm friends with knows, or anybody who, you know, perhaps is friends with me on Facebook, even though I don't post a lot of politics on Facebook, but maybe they follow me on Twitter where I post a little bit here and there. I can't say I've been persecuted or attacked for that too by any extent. I mean, really, the vast majority of my friends, no matter how liberal they are, you know, pretty nice to me about it, and we have good discussion sometimes. Sometimes they get horrifically unpleasant, but you know, that happens when you talk about politics. So, it hasn't really been any problem. I mean, in a sense, I guess it's done me well and that I've been able to write for outlets like the Washington Times and Big Hollywood, which otherwise, if I were on the other side of things, I might not have had a chance to write there. I might not be a good fit, so I guess in that sense, once again, it's something that has helped set me apart, as opposed to, you know, if you want to look for, say, you know, liberal cinephiles in Los Angeles, I mean, you know, that's probably, what, 95% of them or more? So, I mean, in a way, someone like Danny is kind of interesting to me because he basically just developed the opinion on his own in a liberal area with a family, my knowledge, wasn't particularly political, so, in comparison, mine's probably kind of mundane, but, you know, I try to challenge myself a little bit here and there.
I mean, because, yeah, that is something I did notice about you as a critic, being you do not make an agenda a lot of the pieces you write about. I mean, yeah, I know much about, you know, about your piece on Lincoln, because you kind of, you know, wasn't exactly very fond of that film. But in terms of just movies in general, whether it's, I mean, it was, like you said, you wasn't fond of Lincoln, but you were fond of Zero Dark Thirty. You thought that was a very good film, and I think it was out in your honorable mentions of 10 best of 12.
Yeah, that was one of the, I guess that had probably been my, you know, 12th or 13th favorite movie of last year or something like that.
Yeah, so you know to separate that, you know, your personal beliefs, political beliefs, from your position, which is being a film critic and just reviewing the film on your own merits. Reviewing the movie as that is, and and that's something even also Victor Morton has. He's very he may refer to himself as a right wing film geek, but he knows how to separate what he believes from what he has to do as a critic. And and it's funny, when people think of conservative film critics, they think of people like Michael Medved. Or, Debbie Schlussel, I don't know if he's still around doing stuff, but it's just like, those people who seem to have that thing where it's just like, it's all about an agenda, and just, I mean, I don't know if you find that off-putting, or just like something you prefer not to get into, because you have your own sense of how to be a film critic, and just, I just want to get your take on all that.
Well, I don't find it inherently off-putting, we can't, no one's an island, and it's no matter how hard you try, it's impossible to divorce yourself from your writing, and in fact, you shouldn't do that. I mean, you're giving your own opinion, and that's part of who you are and all that, but, someone like Debbie Schlussel, I mean, if you want to dignify her with the label film critic, I mean, she's hyperactively off-putting, but, you can definitely do it that way, just like if on the left, you just reviewed everything from like an obnoxiously, Marxist perspective or something. It would be, probably wouldn't make for very good film writing. I can get irritated by things in movies. If I think if a movie has a stamp on something I find, inherently wrong, I mean, I reserve the right to say, this movie sucks because they said so and so, and I don't agree with that. But I'm more interested in movies than politics, so, really with most movies, it's just not something that comes up, and, whatever they say, I don't think most movies are really, the vast majority of them are really made to appeal to Democrats or Republicans or conservatives or liberals, it's all commerce, so to some extent, I think most of these people know that, you'll probably, it's a better bet to try to get, a wider audience, so, but yeah, just it's my own writing, and it's just something that comes up a lot. I really don't have, very rarely do I even tempted to write anything that would show my political views on something where, it maybe does come up, in my Killing Them Softly review, but, I give that an A, and I'm sure that's probably more considered to be a liberal movie, so I think I've done pretty well with balancing that. But, whatever someone wants to write, that's fine. Kyle Smith of the Post wants to say Wally's a bunch of garbage because it's into environmentalism. Then hey, that's cool if that's what you think. So.
It's funny just looking through your top 10 list from last year, because it was an interesting collection. Starting at the top, at the number 10 was Cloud Atlas. It's funny. I love the description. The half the cast there, and they keep pop up in roles that, they're not really equipped for, and just like the whole message the new agey stuff wasn't really that hidden in that way, but it was just such a just an outside the mainstream type of film for what it was. And just, yeah, and that was kind of like, it was, yeah, I thought it was kind of a half and half deal myself, because just like half of it worked, half of it is like, shit, never mind. And just, you go down the list, number one, of course, was Looper, and, which you enjoy a lot, and then you also have, Savages, which was interesting, because that's, I just couldn't get into that shit. But,
I think I might have been at Don't We Muriel's mode, actually.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know, it's just, you know, it's just, the minute Gossip Girl lady said, I have orgasms, he has wargasms, I just clocked out. I just, like,
that was pretty early on.
Yeah, exactly, just like, shit. It's like, where do you go after that? It's just like, that's kind of like that's the bar, right? What kind of entertainment we're getting into. You have this wide sense of, what you like as a film critic, and you're pretty open to a lot of things, and just, I'm just thinking just like it must be bad for you this time of year, because I'm looking through like the stuff you've reviewed so far, and you seem to be having a horrible time out there.
Oh yeah, I am. You nailed it.
Yeah.
I've not been enjoying my time at the movies this year all that much, and I mean it's not surprising because I mean this is traditionally the weak point in the year. Although I saw two movies in a row, Die Hard 5 and 21 and Over, that I gave an F to, which I hadn't given an F to any movie in the first year of critic speak until about that point. And then I gave it to two movies in a row. So, just been reviewing other stuff like You Like the Call. I gave that I gave it a B-, and actually, a critic on Letterboxd said, like, this looked horrible. And I just said to him, like, well, these guys, especially at this time, I find myself, enjoying well-made junk a lot more than anything else. So
I have no choice, because this is all you're going to see for a while.
It is. And, I just saw G.I. Joe Retaliation, and I gave that a B- also, and maybe that's way too high, but, at the end of it, I was like, whatever, that was, I guess, fun. I use that word in the review. I guess it was fun, although it's more like fun, like if you it's like taking a little kid to Disneyland, your definition of fun from it might not be that you really had, like, fun, but that the day went all right. So, that's all about the movie.
Yeah. You ever think about taking the Ebert route and just taking it slow and just reviewing the movies you want to review and everything?
As long as I'm going to call myself a professional, I guess I really can't. It was one thing with critic speak that is cool is that, Danny has a lot higher threshold for pain than I do. A lot of stuff that I just really don't want to see, he has no problem seeing it, stuff like The Croods, kids movies, horror movies, stuff like that, that I typically don't want to see. Back when I was doing 3 or 4 a week back at a certain point of college, I could see everything then, and I mean, how much should I complain about getting paid to review a lousy movie? I mean, it's a pretty good gig, so I really shouldn't whine about it, but, it was, I did start to get sick of, seeing stuff I didn't really want to see, but I guess that's just part of it. I mean, it'd be hard to be a critic, I think, and just see only stuff you like, or, stuff you want to see. Sometimes you hate stuff that you wanted to see, but, as long as we have critic speak going, and as long as I'm getting checks in from miscellaneous places, I'll see what I need to see, I suppose.
So, am I correct in saying that being a film critic is your main source of income?
I really just put it all under the umbrella of journalism, because I write news articles, and I review video games and TV for the local paper, so I've been writing a lot of TV reviews and a lot of game reviews, and the game part's been kind of fun, because I often get the game for free, I'll get like a brand new game for free that I actually didn't want to play, so that's cool, but I augment the income, I substitute teach, that's something. So I have different ways to pay the rent. But yeah, I mean, journalism's the lion's share of my income right now.
Maybe just it's just in where you live. Maybe Iowa is a Cedar Falls, Iowa. I'm sorry, is a place is not as expensive as Los Angeles. But maybe because as you are being a freelance journalist, I mean, you find it to be a bitch as much as I consider it to be. Considering it a bitch as much as I consider it to be.
It kind of is. I mean, it's cool in the sense that, I just have a pretty open schedule. I can go down to, Mississippi and see my family if I need to, and, I can stay up till, 3 or 4 in the morning on a Wednesday and things like that that most people I know, it's not a luxury that most people I know have, but I have months where I do really well with it and I'm really satisfied, and then I have really lean months where I'm like really nervous and I'm constantly checking my credit card statement and things like that. So I definitely think it is, and it would be nice to have a job where if I have a medical emergency, I won't go into extreme debt at any second, but I've gotten lucky. So I do think it is, and it's not something I recommend to most people, but if you can handle it, then there are perks. I mean, at least that's what I think. What do you think?
I think I'm going to break down and cry at some point. Cause it's kind of gotten to that point where it's just like it's not every day you can say you're basically imprisoned by your own poverty, but it does seem that way, especially where I'm living. And it's not even like a big place like Los Angeles. I live in Raleigh, and there's not much call for the kind of stuff I do. I also do other things as well, just write articles and profiles and reviews and everything, but it's just so difficult getting yourself out there, and also difficult apparently getting checks from people. I don't know how often the checks come to you, but it can be kind of sporadic on occasion. I mean, before I got you on the line, I was going emailing an editor and asking him just like, why the hell does it seem so impossible for me to get paid for what I do for you? And this is the reason why I'm sounding so solemn at this point. I'm sorry for not being as energetic as I was with Danny and a lot of other people, but just like I'm just, as I did on one previous podcast, where I was just like I was trying not to go to my dark place, and just like it's a constant battle, just trying to maintain some modicum of positivity. And I hate spraying this all on you, because you don't necessarily know me. All you know is that you listen to my podcast, and by the way, thank you for that. I don't know, maybe you can help me trying to figure out how I can get other people to listen to it, and hopefully I can get some sponsorship, and maybe people can donate and stuff. Maybe if I just spend an hour just saying how broke I am, and hopefully just like you know, people can, you know, bring that. I'm actually planning to interview a friend of mine later on, and I think we're just going to be talking, just, and he's broke too, so we'll just talk about how broke we are for an hour. So, but it's just a continuous thing. Just like I'm it's gotten to the point now where I'm starting up a new game called Guess What Gets Cut Off First. It's kind of
gets cut off first.
Yeah. Will it be this phone call, or will it be something, the lights or something? Yeah, just, you know, just one of those things.
Honestly, if I didn't split the bills with my girlfriend, I'd probably be at McDonald's in the back, flipping burgers and mopping the floor. I mean, that's a huge part of why I've been able to avoid either a horrible menial job or destitution, at least while pursuing writing. So I guess I've been blessed in that department as well. But I know the feeling. Like, you know, I know what it's like to check the bank account and then check the bills and think, oh man, this is not ideal. So, but for me, at least, it just goes up and down. Last year, at some point, I wrote a few articles in one day with a total to about $800. So I must have made $800 in a day, because I basically did. But then, you know, I'll have a month where, you know, I don't hit $800 for the whole month. So I do have to be careful with what I spend and when, and if I make a bunch of money, I need to make sure I, you know, don't succumb to the temptation to buy myself a really nice present with it or anything like that, so.
And what is the, you know, how long have you had the girlfriend there, if I may ask?
Oh, sure. Since October 2008, so.
Oh, wow, so it's.
Like 4.5 years, something like that, so.
What does she do?
She works at a department store around here, and she hawks Lancome. Apparently, this is a makeup that is kind of costly.
Oh, Lancome, so,
Lancome. I don't know, but I should know the exact pronunciation by now. But she sells that. So, and she's actually going back to school herself to work in like a dentist office. I'm really excited for her in that department. But until then, she'll be she's hawking makeup. But she likes the job all right. So that's pretty good.
Yeah, that's cool. And what are you looking to accomplish, man? Is there any goal you're trying to attain? I just thought of this question, but I really don't ask people this question. But hey, just like you got. Got any lofty dreams and goals or something like that?
Yeah, well, I guess the cul-de-sac around something we talked about earlier. I really do want to get my book published and read, or at least if I can't get that one, then, you know, write another one and get that one. That's certainly very high on my lifetime priority list. I guess I have a bunch of things I can say. This was probably even harder than the novel. I'd like to weigh what I did in my freshman year of college again at some point in time. That would be cool. I'm probably getting several books published would be easier than that, but I can give it a try.
You want to get back to your college weight, you said?
I'm not anything near unique in that, you know, I'm a substantially larger person now than I was when I was 18, 19, but, it's something, because I have a good friend who weighed, like, 315 pounds or something at one point, and he got down to 180, and he's kept at 180 for, like, almost a decade, so I look at people, and I know stuff like that's possible, but that's just harder in contemporary America.
Oh, yeah.
to lose that much weight and you know, I've got 10 fast food restaurants within a quarter mile of my house. Each one tastier than the last, so it's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard. But, you know, I try. That's something, but that's... Well, that would be cool one day, too. But, man, I'm getting up there at 28. I'm already starting to feel age, and I know that every year that kind of thing just gets harder and harder, but I guess it happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, just, you know, you can work, you know, you can always work on that. There's, you know, I don't know how old are you, how old are you, man?
28.
Ah, shit. That's... I'm just 36, and I just... Oh, God damn it. But yeah, like I said, you're talking like it's the end of the world. Like, oh, you like, you know, you can never be skinny again. I'm skinny. Well, no, I'm not skinny. I've lost a lot of weight myself, but most of that is, you know, that's just because I haven't been eating much. But, you know, as you're supposed to not eat much, you know, when you're on it. Yeah, I've been going outside, I've been walking, and just doing some cardio and stuff like that. And so, yeah, so it can be done at this age, this old age I'm at now, just getting increased.
You know, at one point in time, I actually did come pretty close. Before I got together with my current girlfriend, I dated the last one for somewhat over 2.5 years, and I gained a bunch of weight while I was with her, and we broke up, and, you know, within, you know, so I thought, okay, I better get myself back into condition to be on that whole market. So I lost, like 50 pounds in 4 months, and I was exercising twice a day, and I was counting calories and all that stuff. So I do lose a lot of weight fairly quickly, and then I got together with my current girlfriend, and, you know, that all went out the window. I mean, that's a pretty common story of why that happened. So I know it's possible, although now I feel so much older than I was back then. I guess at the time I was like 24 or something.
Yeah.
So I even just those extra 4 years look like a lot, but I know it's possible.
Yeah.
But I know never take weight loss advice from someone who hasn't been overweight in their life. That's my main rule.
Yeah.
And they just say, well, why don't you just eat a few more carrots? They say something like that, you know, people who, you know, they think like, you know, just like a minor change in your lifestyle can take, take a dozen of pounds off, and it's just not something that works.
Well, you know, just as always, as I believe Russell Simmons would say at this point in time, just do you, man. Just do you, and just hopefully just things will, I mean, you know, just things may work out and stuff. But at this point, would you like to promote your online places, the Twitter feed? You have a blog, which you haven't really updated in a while, so maybe, I don't know if you want to tell people about that.
Yeah, there's, you know, obviously anybody listening should go to CriticSpeak.com and peruse not just my writing, but that of Dan Bobland and our, you know, fine contributors and all that. But for Twitter, I just, you know, have a personal account, JFrazier57, FRAZIER.
Yeah.
Not quite like the TV character. And there I just kind of talk about whatever, but, you know, I do post a lot of, pretty much any time something I write is written, I post it on there. And my old blog, you know, that's jamesfrazier.biz, obviously .com, .net, .org, and all those others were taken, so I got .biz. I haven't really updated that much. Once CriticSpeak came along, you know, my reviews were going there, and I just haven't really posted much. I still am paying for the domain, although $10 a year, but I suppose maybe I should at least update it with CriticSpeak link a little more often. But there's not much else to promote otherwise, other than, you know, my just general web presence.
Yeah.
So
Well, aren't you glad I didn't ask you any questions about James Frazer, the Scottish social anthropologist?
I've run across him while Googling myself a few times, although I'm afraid I have no input on him other than that, you know, I have a bunch of Scottish ancestors, so I imagine me and him are probably converge somewhere on a big genealogy map, but unfortunately, I don't really know anything else about any other actual James or Jim Frazers out there.
Well, yeah, that's him, and this is you, and it's been interesting talking to you, sir. It's just
I appreciate you putting me up there. I'm looking forward to hearing myself somewhat. I hate my own voice like most people do, but I'll listen anyway. I didn't say anything too foolish.
Well, at least you're not a black dude that sounds like Eddie Deason. Sorry about that.
Well, he did good work, so.
Oh, yeah. did a lot of stuff. Well, just let me close it out here. As always, this is Craig D. Lindsay saying, I haven't had a good time in 99. I know, fucking rancid.